The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, question for the talk is what's the relationship between psychological and spiritual health? And the kind of different hypotheses around this. One we could say is that sometimes teachers talk about the relative and the absolute, where those two levels are not really connected. It's different realms. The spiritual and the psychological are separate and not strongly correlated. Or maybe alternatively, they have everything to do with each other. And one might make the case that they're not spiritual and psychological health are not two things, and that even, you know, and I'm just putting forward kind of hypotheses, one might make the claim that enlightenment is just a very high level of psychological functioning and health. Third possibility, and noted by Jack Engler and that kind of famous line, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody, right? Where the view is that psychological health is a kind of precondition, making the heart mind fertile for a more radical letting go of self identity. And so in this view, it's like we develop psychological health, and that makes us, gives us the kind of strength and stability in order to, endure some of the more radical disorientation of the spiritual path. And a fourth view, we might argue that spiritual and psychological dimensions are threaded together, and that as we deepen spiritually, there are more and more opportunities for psychological growth, and our psychological growth makes spiritual deepening more possible. And so the question, how do we make sense of all this, these kind of four possibilities? And even before considering that, we might ask why we get into this path. And I would generally say it's usually more for psychological reasons of some kind. It's usually a smaller intention. It's a more transactional intention that gets us into the path, which I'm not disparaging at all. It's like we wish to feel better. And the aspirations tend to begin kind of small, like we could say we don't really know what we're when we set in. Maybe this was not your first entry into the kind of Dharma world, but if it was the first time you set foot into IMC. You could not really give informed consent for what the path was going to ask of you and do to you. That sounds a little weird, but, you know, it's like one of my teachers, Shinzen Young, would say, there's no informed consent for enlightenment, you know? You kind of don't know exactly what this thing is, but it almost always starts in a more compartmentalized manner. And then we see, okay, this is deep, this is vast, and this is about my conditioning, all my behavior, all my suffering, all my love. And so just the first point to make is that how we think about the relationship between the spiritual and psychological, that changes over the course of practice. So looping back to that first hypothesis, like relative and absolute. And in the absolute, it's sometimes characterizes all one, it's unity, it's total peace. And in the relative But then we say in the relative world, like, please don't, you know, wear your shoes home, not mine, you know, that kind of thing out there, right? And there are two dimensions of the path. And psychological growth is about healing ourselves. Absolute is about knowing some other realm of truth. But for me, and this is just my, to my mind, I've always been a little bit, kind of suspicious of the use of language to hide conceptual confusion. And, I think we can honor what is ineffable, what we cannot speak. We can honor the apparent paradoxes of the path, the dynamic tensions of Dharma. But in the end, there's just one world of experience. And as hard as it is, I think we should be able to speak about it as one world. Wittgenstein said, philosopher said, philosophy is a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language.
Say that again.
Okay. Philosophy is a battle against the bewitchment of our intelligence by means of language. So I've had the sense that the need to invoke the absolute as some separate realm is a way of, and this is getting a little technical, but as a way of attempting to preserve our metaphysical commitments while trying to speak coherently about the ordinary psychological growth and differentiation. And my sense is, you know, sometimes it's like the absolute and the relative are postulated as a way of explaining the divergence between those two. That you have somebody who seems really deep about, you know, something, but is functioning poorly, maybe doing harm psychologically, right? And so it's meant to explain this lack of tethering between ordinary psychological functioning and deep wisdom. But to my mind, it's like if deep wisdom doesn't change something about how we treat ourselves, how we treat each other, if the spiritual and the psychological are completely untethered, the absolute and the relative are not wedded in some way, I don't know what those insights are worth exactly. Does that make sense? If the kind of spiritual deepening does not in some way catalyze changes in how we are with each other, I don't know exactly how much it's worth. The second hypothesis that psychological and spiritual growth are continuous. They're part of the same process. And awakening is just a kind of extreme case of psychological flourishing. So sometimes, people who are interested in mindfulness or spirituality, they may be intimidated by some of this radical language around awakening and want to essentially graft awakening into a psychological framework. So it's a little less intimidating, you know, and we just sort of like, well, we just kind of wedge some of the Buddha's vision into more traditional psychological frameworks. And I get that, you know, and certainly there is a lot of synergy happening between Dharma and mental health and a great deal of interest, you know, around this. So this is one kind of leading, prominent researcher in psychological realm says, we are witnessing, quote, a shift from having our mental health defined by the content of our thoughts to having it defined by our relationship to that content and changing that relationship by sitting with, noticing, and becoming disentangled from our definition of ourselves. Does that sound familiar? Yeah, that they should pay royalties to the Buddha or something like that, you know. So psychotherapy is a, you know, there's a lot of ways in which there is continuity between the psychological and the spiritual. This is, you know, the basic currency of a lot of therapy is insight. We're at the Insight Meditation Center. And the Buddha anticipated many different dimensions of psychotherapeutic healing, you know, and we can say that, the Dharma, functions as a kind of cognitive therapy, as an existential therapy, as an attentional treatment, as a exposure therapy. The Dharma, in other words, it really does function well in delivering some psychological healing. And at some point, psychological growth hits a kind of ceiling. And to become better adjusted, you know, we're just fiddling at the margins. And yeah, I could heal more psychologically, but it will not make dramatic impacts on my well-being, right? So Freud, reflecting on the limits of psychoanalysis, said, "Much will be gained if we succeed in transforming your hysterical misery into common unhappiness." Like, okay, well, yeah, I'm glad I'm not hysterically miserable. And is my aspiration any higher than common unhappiness? I think the Buddha's was, right? But it's like, okay, what can be done? What can be done with the kind of existential realities and intensities? And to my mind, yeah, even the really, and I'm not dismissive of it. Like I have a lot of reverence for the psychologically well-adjusted life. And even that well-adjusted life contains a tremendous amount of dukkha, you know. Maslow said what we call normal in psychology is really a psychopathology of the average, so undramatic and widely spread that we don't even notice it ordinarily. And so spiritual practice at some level picks up where psychological health ends. And there's a kind of, and this entails something, different components of the path become operative as we, you know, find ourselves like reasonably happy enough. We have what we think should make us happy, and yet there's still some very deep longing in us. And at that point, the path, there's a kind of phase shift, and there's the turn towards more spiritual thriving entails deeper renunciation, different kind of attentional development, samadhi, a deeper surrender. We exit from realms of meaning making where the currency is understanding into realms where the perception is shifted. There's a deepening ethical sensitivity as we make the move from psychological well-being into, you know, more and more spiritual freedom. And so I'm making the case that, like, okay, I don't think you can quite say that it's completely continuous, that awakening is just a kind of radical kind of psychological flourishing. third possibility, that line from Engler, you know, getting the question of like somebody with a psychiatric condition where there's like highly unstable sense of self and ownership and boundary. And the question that was posed to him as a, I think, a psychologist and Buddhist writer, and says, are they, is that person close to understanding not self, anatta? And the kind of famous response was, you have to be somebody before you can be nobody. And the implication being that you sort of have to have a solid sense of self before you can shed that self. And many years later, he was interviewed and asked where he stood on that quote. And he said, in a general way, I'd stand by it. You have to be somebody before you can be nobody, although it's a provocative way of putting it. What I had in mind when making that statement was that if you're going to go to the depths of Buddhist mindfulness practice, it requires certain psychological capacities, what in the psychoanalytic tradition would be called certain basic ego strengths. And those ego strengths form around some stable sense of who you are, some stable sense of identity. And I still believe that's true. So here the view is that psychological development essentially precedes the spiritual development. And, yeah, you know, and I think there's something to be said for that. I think there's times when we can kind of like, where people sort of like brute force their way into certain states of emptiness or something. And, there's a way in which it can be that it's like our own historical psychological pain tends to get threaded together with even genuine insight, understanding, selflessness. And there's something, that, you know, these kinds of realizations and understandings are lead and point towards health, but they often also bring along some of our own psychological complexity. And so Engler's point here is that we are cultivating a kind of healthy home base in a way before we leave home radically. And and I think some of this happens quite naturally on the path, that the Dharma really does function as a way of supporting the kind of psychological health and capacity that's required in order to bear with some of the disorientation of the spiritual path. And so there, we could say there are many, many therapeutic dimensions of Dharma. I was beginning to allude to some of it, but it's like our suffering. And for me, this was so important, you know, our suffering is normalized. The First Noble Truth, that there is dukkha, that it did not begin with you, that it is not your fault, that you do not govern that. Just that. Hearing that can be like medicine. And so this is one of the dimensions of psychological healing, the early phases of the path. And we grow in self-understanding. We learn more about what voices are trustworthy inside of us. We heal a lot about Dharma. We talk about being present. But a lot of what Dharma does and a lot of what practice does is that the past is re-experienced in the present, that memory returns to us. And what was undigested or incomplete in our own psychological history, what left a kind of electrified trace returns to us in the present moment and begs to be blessed by awareness and love. And over time, it does that. The path does that. And so that this begins to allow us to feel more and more safe in the process of letting go, in the process of deepening. And so when it feels like there are kind of, you know, deep wounds, and it almost, the way it feels to me is almost like there's some memory that there's secrets locked up in that pain. And I don't know what they are. I don't know what they mean about me or my future. But until I understand, they can have this function of having a kind of like ominous, haunting presence. The past is not past, right? And over the course of a Dharma practice life, we heal more and more of that. And then we become, it feels safer and safer to be able to let go. And then we, in this view, this third view, we become healthy enough to weather the storms, the kind of intense, you know, evocative, affective, emotional storms of spiritual path, where all the ordinary tethers on our okayness, all the familiar reference points, all the kind of familiar soothing stories that we pacify our mind with, they're all crumbling in the light of attention. And in that context, it's like, oh yeah, there's what Engler says, a lot of strength is needed to bear with that without being, you know, obliterated by some of that. So, okay, that's the more linear. And then the fourth possibility, is that, I suggested, and this is how I see it, is that they're more threaded together, the spiritual and the psychological. It's not linear or sequential. We heal ourselves and then we do spiritual practice, that they're threaded together, and that psychological issues highlight zones and motivation for spiritual growth. Psychological growth frees us up for the more radical rigors of spiritual practice. And that spiritual practice reveals areas, shines a kind of spotlight on zones of psychological pain that we've just sort of maneuvered around without meeting fully. And so in this view, it's not that we do one or the other, and it's not that they're unrelated and they're not the same thing. It's that, and as Engler actually says in that interview, I don't see it quite so linear or exclusive anymore. And so the psychological healing of kindness, tenderness, self-care, self-love, and selflessness evolve together. And so self-love is not the celebration of a kind of permanent self-existing entity that is me and just good. It used to be bad, but now it's good. Self-love is not a kind of emotionally charged story about the essence of my being. Self-love is a kind of forgiveness and a deep honoring of the totality of one's conditioning and a recognition of the kind of underlying innocence of that conditioning. And so to love oneself is not to cherish or elevate the self or to claim ownership. Self-love is an expression of non-clinging. It's like the first taste of the emptiness of self. This kind of very gentle way of holding self-story. And self-love is the beginning of the, we would say, like the unbinding of views that had been previously grafted into the self model. Researcher Lethaby says, in ordinary waking consciousness, representations that are bound to the self model, including our deeply held, often unconscious beliefs about ourselves and our lives, typically don't attract explicit critical attention or reflection. They are experienced as reality itself, or as that with which we see the world rather than a part of the world that we see. When the binding of these stimuli into the self model is disrupted, we disidentify with them in a very straightforward way, rendering them opaque. They're no longer experienced as part of me, but as something separate, an object or appearance in consciousness to which I can attend with some sense of critical distance. So self-hatred is this kind of being very deeply identified, and self-love, self-acceptance is moving to the point where we're beginning to disidentify more and more with the self story. And that is the kind of, we begin to move into this realm of insight into not self, which is actually, in a sense, just a more radical form of accepting the components of the self as they arise moment by moment. And we find that, yeah, we could say something like anatta is the deepest form of self-acceptance. And the self that is loved is easier to forget than the self that is hated. So we heal on this path in many ways, and we have these more kind of radical breaks with disidentification, where even what seemed unquestioned, transparent, we never noticed, we just saw through, becomes opaque. We become disidentified with these assumptions, views. But that's not permanent. The self rearises. And yeah, we know it more deeply and we know how innocent it is, but it does keep rearising. And even deep insight into selflessness does not erase our psychological conditioning. It does not, right? It's like Ajahn Sumedho famously said, it's not your personality that becomes enlightened, you know? Not your personality. That stays, right, in some way. There's some measure of continuity with that. And spiritual practice is in some sense, yeah, is it makes our psychological pain more vivid. It makes the moments of compulsivity and dysfunction, psychological dysfunction and weird neurosis and kind of patterns. It's like we've seen it a million times and still it feels like I've been commanded by God to act it out at Christmas dinner or whatever, you know, or whatever, right? And like, okay, you know, right? So spiritual practice is not a kind of erasing of that. It's like it's a dramatizing of it. And we now see just how unfree that is. And that's both humbling and confusing and motivating. But often it motivates us in a kind of way that contracts the mind, in a way that mobilizes our willfulness to try to manhandle our psychological pain. As Chris McKenna and Megan Cowan kind of condensed a few lines of something they wrote. So say, the repetitious quality of conditioned patterns and core wounds is like the dirty secret of long-term spiritual practice. Difficult as it is to admit, any honest assessment of our own path is likely going to include a reckoning with a short list of conditioned patterns that we seem to be experiencing and learning through over decades, not weeks, not months, not years, decades. Any inner arising that comes deeply coupled with the intense doubt and confusion is a place where we have not yet let clarity penetrate completely and totally. By going into the place where we get most psychologically and energetically disorganized over and over again, you find a depth of knowing and freedom that's simply unavailable through any other means. The healing process actually gets interesting precisely when we gain the confidence in our own ability to connect with ourselves deeply and intuitively, and read how to meet what arises moment by moment in all aspects of our experience. We see it as something we've been given to truly study. What dedicating the merit of our practice really means is that this headway is effortlessly shared with all that is, and in particular with other sentient beings that are working with this issue. It's touching to me, you know, to share the merit of our practice. In these realms where we get so energetically disorganized and overwhelmed, and the line between awareness and complete collapse into rumination or whatever is very thin. It's almost like to touch that object is to be lost in it, right? You start to see this. You start to see, you know, this spiritual practice illuminates the patterns by which our compulsivity, there's enough mindfulness to see the collapse of mindfulness. There's enough mindfulness to see how awareness becomes completely absorbed in that psychological material. And this is like a realm of deep compassion, you know, of willingness rather than willfulness. Because we've tried to like will our way through that or practice our way through that. And it's like, no, this is such a state of vulnerability, of desperation, even if it's subtle, even if it's not, we're not causing big harm, we're not, you know, creating big dramatic fractures in relationships or something. It might be very subtle, but you can feel how unfree it is and how desperate we are to actually heal. And yet, it unfolds, not over months or years, but decades. And it's like Michelle McDonald called it a karmic knot, you know? It's with us for this life. And our job is to begin to make a relationship with it. And our spiritual practice helps illuminate the spiritual urgency of that task. And yet we find ourselves kind of like so frozen in it. And even one degree of freedom in those realms is worth a lot. Yeah. And when we get even one degree of freedom and we say, like, I dedicate the merit of my practice to all beings, and especially those who suffer in this way. It's beautiful. So we want to get interested in how the energy of this particular psychological knot absorbs the awareness. And in a sense, it's like if we could have healed it in a kind of ordinary psychological way, it would have been more healed, you know? And it is asking for our own spiritual attention, but with a great deal of patience and tenderness, respect, reverence, really. Sometimes Gil says we have developed reverence for, I think I heard him say, like, reverence for our clinging. So the patience required is often more patience than we have, because we're learning about old things in our own ancestry, genetic lineage, deeper into deep time. We're learning about what it's like to be an animal, you know, conditioned by millions of years of evolution, and in certain modes where it's like everything in our being says, like, I must enact this. And there tends to be a great deal of aversion and self-harshness, and in a way, the self-harshness is just a kind of, is almost preferable to the truth of opening to the ungovernability and the sense of helplessness in some of these trenches of psychological pain. And so the self-harshness is just like little kind of palliative, you know, cough drop that, you know, as if to pretend like, well, I just have to try harder. I just messed it up because I didn't do it well enough. You know, it's like, no. That's actually easier to swallow than the truth of helplessness in those moments. But we try to rally our spiritual kind of strength. Okay, let me be willing to experience this helplessness with some vividness. And this engenders more kind of commitment to continuing to grow and develop a relationship with these dimensions of ourselves. And so this fourth kind of hypothesis, whereby spirituality, spiritual growth, the deepening understanding of self is always is threaded together with psychological healing. And we just keep going until we're free. We just keep going, you know. And sometimes the spiritual will act like a magnet for a psychological pain. Sometimes the psychological healing will act like a magnet for our spiritual growth. And in the end, I think we don't even need to care. What, you know, it's just conditioning that points towards suffering or freedom, yours, mine. So we keep going. Offer this for consideration. We have a couple minutes if there are any questions.
What is the role for psychotherapy or psychological healing after a certain level of development? Like, you know, in scenarios 2 and 3, mm-hmm. It seems like there's like, you know, growth up to a certain point through psychological mm-hmm. healing, and beyond that, there's like a sort of different trajectory of spiritual mm-hmm. healing. After that point, is there any role for the psychological?
Yeah. I would say there often is that as we actually like get freer, it's almost like it sort of drops the waterline of sorts, you know, on our psychological health in the sense that we can see more about it, and we can see these grizzled bits that somehow have been completely insulated from Dharma practice, you know? And at that point, it may be that the medicine is some more psychological or psychotherapeutic thing. It may be spiritual practice. Don't know. But there is the sense of like, okay, some of this conditioning has been revealed. And now actually it's so much less personal, and there's so much confidence that like, whatever I find about myself will not be a cause for less care or love of myself, that it engenders this kind of almost like reckless self-exploration where it's like, okay, there's the mechanisms of shame. I'm ashamed of my pain, or ashamed of my compulsivity, or ashamed of the ways in which I'm not free. Like, none of that feels like it's so personal anymore. And so it creates this kind of willingness to just like move radically into that, the kind of conditioning. And I feel like it's almost like a kind of, and certainly as, you know, Buddhist teachers or leaders or something like that, it's almost like a moral obligation to stay very curious about one's neurosis. You know, because it can sometimes be a sort of like certain kind of arrogance creeps up and crystallizes around some of the spiritual power. And then we get less interested in, you know, we get a little less interested in our psychological pain, but it's like, no, this is illuminating where we can be more free. Does that speak to it?
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Is it going to be like, are you going to stump me and it's going to be a long question, Sylvie?
You can ask
you privately. Okay. Just ask it. I won't answer.
Okay, my name is Sylvie. When you were giving this talk, I was thinking about something that Gil has said sometimes about on the path. We don't solve our problems, we dissolve them. Mm. You know, he's kind of using that kind of concept. And I was wondering if, you know, the psychological path is like closer to solving and the Dharma is closer to dissolving, and to me, I'm never really satisfied with dissolving my problem, and so I feel it's like a mix of the two. That was my question.
That's great. I have to answer it, even though we're over time. So there's a lot that we could say about that. But yeah, I think So the question of solving one's problems versus like maybe spiritual is solving, or psychological is solving one's spiritual as dissolving one's problems, and not necessarily being satisfied with dissolving the problems, and how to think about those realms. I agree with how you put it. I do feel like often spiritual practice, it's like what we thought our problems were dissolve in the light of awareness. It's not that we got an answer. It's that the question dissolved, or we saw that the framework that made that thing a problem in the way it was, that made it not just an issue, not just unpleasant, but a burden on the heart, something about the view shifts. And then it really is, you really like can live a kind of, in some sense, a problemless life, you know? It's not that one doesn't have pain and unpleasantness and questions and grief and, you know, a million tears for the world, and you know, but in some sense there's no sense of like life as a problem, but life as a kind of massage of sorts. And that I think is real. But I would also say, like, we probably don't want to be too rigid about it, that sometimes Dharma is like very good at solving problems and being analytical and being able to actually predict what can work or not work, you know? And that's like, and some psychological healing for sure also does the same dissolution kind of process too. But we have to feel like when something does dissolve, it's like thoroughly dissolved, that we're not being asked to pretend like something doesn't bother us when it does. And the Dharma never asks us to pretend. So we can't get too, doctrinaire or something about how it's supposed to work. We just like, it's a radical honesty with whatever knots or space there is in the heart in the moment. Okay, YouTube crew. See you. Thank you all. Yeah.